Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin and talk about the incident in Khobar in the oil-producing part of Saudi Arabia, where a group of terrorists took a lot of Western and Filipino oil workers hostage. We'll look into that, whether it's a precursor for things to come, and also talk about the appointment of Iyad Alawi to lead the new Iraqi government at the end of this coming month, on July the 4th. And we'll be talking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the Central Intelligence Agency. He's had long been a student of that part of the world and speaks Arabic and often appears on Al Jazeera as a private citizen. And we'll also speak with Robert Baer, a former CIA officer who's the author of See No Evil, recounting his experiences in the north of Iraq with the Kurds during the interregnum between the two Iraq wars. And he's recently wrote a scathing book about the Saudi Arabia and the United States government's relationship, various administrations' relationship with the House of Saud, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. So we look into both the Iraq and the Saudi situation with Graham Fuller and Robert Baer in a moment. We'll also talk about the oil market with Fidel Gate, who is a graduate of Cairo University, New York University. He is currently the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas with Oppenheimer and Company in New York. And Mr. Gate has spent more than 30 years in the oil and gas in the energy sector. He's previously worked for Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan. So we'll be talking to him about how what is behind this $40 a barrel oil price at the moment, and how much it's driven by fear and insecurity about the market. In effect, we have an ironic situation where the oil market is essentially repudiating a Bush. Normally, the oil markets have been friendly to the Bush family. So we'll look into whether the connection between U.S. foreign policy and the price of oil, which may, of course, rapidly rise if there's a more instability inside Saudi Arabia. Then finally, we'll talk in the first hour with Matthew Bunn, who's a senior research associate at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of a new report that just came out this week, Securing the Bomb, An Agenda for Action. And we'll be talking to him about the lack of attention on the part of the Bush administration to the still unsecured amounts, humongous amounts of fissile material inside the former Soviet Union, a lot of which is not guarded, and explore the notion that perhaps because we are distracted in Iraq, we are not able to watch the ball on this incredibly important subject, given that all it requires to for a terrorist to get hold of a nuclear weapon, most specialists believe that it's possible to make a nuclear weapon, a crude one, like the Hiroshima bomb, which wasn't tested. All you need is a U-235, and there are tons and tons of U-235 that are not properly guarded. I'm speaking with Robert Baer, a former CIA officer, author of See No Evil, which recounts your time in the north with the Kurds, and then I believe it's being made into a movie, I read somewhere, and then also Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the Central Intelligence Agency. Beginning with you, Graham Fuller, let me ask you how they came to choose this new leader in Iraq. It looks as though, first of all, it looks as though the White House and the administration abdicated there and allowed Brahimi, the Algerian from the United Nations, to essentially choose the new leader of this new Iraqi government. But even Brahimi apparently was out of the loop on this one, and he was chosen, I guess, by his the governing council counterparts. Is that right?
Well, I think this is part of a broader tug of war between the administration and Ibrahimi. In fact, Bush, astonishingly, a number of weeks ago said, when somebody asked him about the composition of the forthcoming government, he said, "I don't know, talk to Brahimi." But the fact is that they want the seal of good housekeeping that the UN can bring to the nomination of a future interim government, but they don't want all the baggage that comes along with the UN, and they're trying to have it both ways. Here is the problem. I think Brahimi all along has preferred much more of a kind of professional, apolitical government that would serve simply to shepherd the government through to a period of genuine elections down the road, whereas the U.S. wants to try to the maximum degree preserve its investment in the country and its geopolitical aims, which I would argue are vanishing by the day, but in any case to try to preserve those by pushing their candidate. And I think there's been something of a misunderstanding between the two sides as to whether this guy is really the person that Brahimi wants. Clearly, I think he is not.
Well, what do you think happened here, though? Is this trying to cut bait and come up with some kind of confection here? A cover to get out? It doesn't sound like the same government that went in there that was so confident.
You're absolutely right, Ian. I think the administration has abandoned wholesale a huge number of goals that they had originally for Iraq. They were talking about having 4 or 5 military bases there. It would be a strong pro-American center for the extension of American projection of American power throughout the region and part of a broader democratization process, and we'd squeeze all the neighboring regimes, and one by one they would sort of fall into line, and Iraq would be establishing full diplomatic relations with Israel and selling it oil through new pipelines and that type of thing, and Iraq would be the swing producer for oil in the Gulf, replacing Saudi Arabia. All that has gone by the boards, and I think at this point the administration really wants to get out relatively intact with as few casualties as possible, hopefully clinging on to those few remaining geopolitical goals, which would be a government that's pliable enough to allow the American military to stay on and to allow American businesses and oil policies to be set by the U.S. government. I think that's unrealistic and vanishing, too.
Let me bring in Robert Baez, a former CIA officer and author of See No Evil, which was a book about his experiences in the north of Iraq, working with the Kurds, and more recently, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Robert Baez, did you work with Iyad Alawi, the new ruler of...
I know him fairly well. He was based in London, but spent some time in Jordan, and I ran across him more than once.
And he was the head of a group of dissident, even though he's a medical doctor, he was the head of a group of dissident army officers, right?
Iraqi National Accord, which included a lot of officers. It was a very loose organization, which had aspirations of leading a coup in Iraq of Baathist military officers. It was accused in 1996 of attempting a coup, which Saddam caught on to and arrested a few people. But that's been completely overblown, his influence in the army.
Mm-hmm. So is he's not another Chalabi then, is he? That's all resume and no substance?
He suffers from some of that. He's an exile. He does very well. He's made a lot of money over the years. He provided bad information leading up to the war, the famous 45-minute time fuse for Saddam to mount his weapons of mass destruction. He's been accused of being responsible for that piece of information, which led us into the war.
So how did he get chosen, apparently without Brahimi, his involvement, and without Bremer's involvement?
Oh, he was. I really can't tell you for sure, but he was a favorite of the CIA. He's much less controversial than Ahmad Chalabi. He had more quiet support among American, bureaucrats in Washington, in the military as well as the CIA. He's a compromise candidate. I think the governing council wanted to get one of their own in there to assure their continuity. Now he holds about a third of the positions in the current government, relatives. And he's also a relative of Chalabi, but it's said that they don't get along, and I don't think they do.
Well, Chalabi's accusing the CIA of basically sliming him and doing a campaign of character assassination. It's not as if they don't have a lot to work with. He's got a 22-year jail sentence waiting for him in Jordan.
Not only that, but he's been much too close to Iran. He tried to introduce me to two Iranian intelligence officers in 1995 when I was in Iraq, which was, you know, was forbidden for the CIA to open a back channel to Iran. He used to travel through Tehran to get to northern Iraq. He used to give facilities to the Iranian intelligence in northern Iraq. He tried to introduce Scott Ritter, the weapons inspector, to the Iranians. So he never really tried to hide it. It's just that people caught on so late, 2 years too late, in fact.
Well, let me ask Graham Fuller, what's going on here, though, in terms of the Saudi Arabia and the... Let me just give you some statistics here, but rough statistics. Apparently, the majority of the prisoners in Guantanamo, the seriously dangerous ones, are Saudis. The majority that they've picked up in Afghanistan that have been shooting at them have been Saudis. The recent leader of the Chechen rebels who was just killed was a Saudi. And apparently it was a Saudi who just killed the, a week or so ago, killed the president of the Iraqi Governing Council. So is there something happening here that we're missing?
Well, I don't think you all of this is made possible only by Saudi Arabia, but the fact is that Saudi Arabia's immense wealth and commitment to Wahhabi ideology, which, by the way, doesn't have to be violent, but often encourages. If you have that radical a view about Islam, it's not that hard to slip over into violence. But Wahhabis at home mostly aren't violent. But anyway, I think the difficulty is that. The Saudis have now had such influence financially and even with their own personnel that they're beginning to now take bead once again on the home country. They can be struggling for Islamic government and Islamic justice elsewhere in the world, and they, of course, know that it does not exist at home. So I think we're beginning to see... this is part of a long debate, actually, among these people between bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri about whether you should hit the Americans or hit the Americans' puppets, if you will, in their minds around the region. And at this point, I think they're probably going to go both ways. But clearly, they're trying now to drive all foreigners out of Saudi Arabia, which is a clear sign of a increasing security disaster. And they're going to, I would guess, continue to do that until all foreigners are out. And then work on the regime itself at the same time.
Well, Robert Baird, it seems, though, that this this group who attacked the residential compound in Koba, they may not have been hardcore al-Qaeda. They may be sort of freelancers, and I guess that's the nature of al-Qaeda. They franchise out to anybody who wants to pull off an operation. There's a sense that they weren't entirely competent. They were wearing Saudi police uniforms, some of them, and I believe that I mean, I don't know how you prove the statistic, but somebody told me that most of the Saudi police are recruited from the south, and there's tremendous sympathy down there towards Yemen for al-Qaeda. So. I mean, apparently they came in and they said to the guards, don't worry, you're not infidels, we're not going to hurt you. And then some poor Filipino walked by and they said to him in Arabic, are you a Muslim? He didn't understand Arabic, so they shot him in the head. So tell me about what you think in terms of how much the al-Qaeda sympathies have permeated let's start with the Saudi police.
I think very much. We had indications of this in the mid-90s that there were fundamentalists, if you like, embedded in the Saudi military and the Saudi police. The Saudi royal family knew about them, but they were from powerful tribes, some of them Yemeni tribes in the south, some of them even from the Najd, where Al Saud are from in the northeast. They thought they were benign. They let them recruit and go on. But what's happened now is that these people are starting to react, starting to follow the religious orders of bin Laden and other clerics, fatwas, as they're called, and I think the Saudis really can't get a grip on closing this movement down because it's so pervasive. Another thing that is absolutely, you know, is a recruiting drive for this is the war in Iraq and what Sharon is doing in Gaza, because they look at the fundamentalists, the militants, look at this as part and parcel of the same problem. It's the West against Islam, whether it's Israel or the United States or Britain, and they believe they're in some apocalyptic war, and that's why they're ready to commit suicide, to drive foreigners out, and bring the Al Saud down. The Saudi royal family, of course, never planned this, but it's gotten out of hand. And remember, Saudi Arabia is a police state, and if they really had a grip on who these people were, they'd be all in jail now. But the point is, there's more of them. They don't know how many there are. Clearly, it's a minority of Saudis, but is it a minority enough to bring down the oil industry, for instance, or even the royal family?
And Graham Fuller, do you believe that the Bush administration's relationship with Sharon and the apparent abdicating or abandoning any pretext of being an honest broker there is driving this thing? I mean, in other words, if by some miracle the Israelis and the Palestinians could make a deal, do you think that terrorism would go away?
Well, the problem is that we're dealing now with decades long of images coming out of this region. The Palestinians now are the preeminent symbol, I think, for most, certainly all Arabs and most Muslims as well, of a people who have been displaced, lost their homes and mistreated and have been under 36 years of occupation. So, yes, I mean, if I had to name the number one thing that's essential for the United States to do, it would be to bring about a rapid and just solution of the Palestinian problem. And everybody knows basically what the outlines of that problem are. It doesn't mean it's going to go away overnight, because it's now been, as you were suggesting, it's now been intensified. And Bob mentioned as well, it's been intensified by the war in Iraq. All of this is seen as a war against Islam, and the United States now is seen. When you watch satellite television in the area, and I've just come back from another trip to the region, watching Arab satellite television, these images of Palestine and Iraq, occupied Palestine, occupied Iraq, are run right parallel to each other. It's seen by the region as exactly the same phenomenon. Interestingly enough, while I was out there, both leading satellite channels, Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, interrupted their regular programming to bring their publics Bush's address and greeting and address at the AIPAC, the pro-Israeli lobby in Washington, and carry that in full, and of course it was a political event, and everything that Bush said and the lavish introductions of him as the greatest friend that Israel had ever had in the history of the American presidency, all of this just fulfilled every single fear and anxiety that people have in the region that's what this is all about. It's an Israeli-American condominium to run the world, to run the Middle East as they see it. That's going to take some time to reverse, but we have to start very soon.
Well, of course, in the context of AIPAC, it's hard to tell whether George Bush or George W. Bush or John Kerry, who is sucking up the most to AIPAC at the moment. It's almost a competition for AIPAC's affection.
That's politics. I agree. Politics. But, I mean, the fact is, the facts speak for the Bush administration's virtual carte blanche to Sharon, and that is much more important even than just the rhetoric of Kerry or Clinton or anybody else.
Robert Baer, last time we spoke, you said that much of the trouble with the so-called Sunni triangle was essentially why the Shiites were quiescent or apparently quiet, was because this was before Muqtada al-Sadr started his Mahdi army and their face-off with the United States. But prior to that, you were saying that the Shiites are keeping their powder dry simply because we're beating up on the Sunni. And it seems that in the north, the Kurds seem to be getting on with it. They've had a 10-year jump on the rest of Iraq, having had some autonomy and freedom from Saddam's regime. But where does it stand now? Because it's hard to see whether this government is anything more than some kind of fiction. Let's assume that we get to July the 1st and they're all announced who they are and all their ministries, etc. But there's still the country doesn't seem to be anybody in charge, really. And how do you see this playing out? I would have thought as we get through the summer. One of the strange things that the Bush administration does is they explain the adversity by saying, well, things are getting worse because this is a run-up to the handover of independence. So they're trying to make a virtue out of this ridiculously bad situation by saying, well, it's only because of the run-up to the handover, but maybe there's something else going on here.
Well, that's a complete contortion of what is going on in Iraq. Indeed, the Shia were quiescent. They, in a way, supported the Sunni in Fallujah and Ramadi. Once we turned over those two areas to a governor, an ex-governor of the province, of Anbar province, everything quieted down and there was a certain sense of order. But the Sunnis looked at that as a victory. They said, this is what we always wanted, was one of our own in charge, and we gave it to them after the Marines decided not to go all the way into Fallujah. At the same time, though, we couldn't win this particular battle because the Shia are looking at it of us turning the country back over to the Baathis. And that's about the time that Muqtada Sadr started fighting back and started the entire rhetoric in his press, and we closed it down. The Shia community is very much divided, yet at the same time, the Iranians are playing their cards very carefully. What they want to happen is the United States to leave in 5-6 months and turn the country over to some democratic mechanism which will allow them to maintain control of Baghdad and most of Iraq, because they're approximately 60% of the population. The Iranians are looking at this as they've already won the game, but how the cards are played is very important for them. If in 6 months there's still no move toward a democratic election, one man, one vote, I think we're going to see the Shia, you know, picking up their resistance to the Americans, hoping to force them out, and then they can just seize what they can in the country. The Kurds, on the other hand, are more or less independent at this point. There's almost no forces up in the north. They've had a lot of experience governing themselves. Yet, then, the downside of this is it scared the Turks and it scared the Iranians that there's going to be an independent Kurdish state and there's going to be a de facto partition of Iraq. So, I mean, we have a long way to go, and I don't see any happy end to all this in sight.
And Graham Fuller, do you have any sense that there's any good news that could possibly come out of this, or even is it possible in this political year for the administration, given the ascendancy of Karl Rove during the political season, to somehow cosmetically declare victory and get out?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think there are any good options exactly. A year ago, there were a lot of options. 6 months ago, they were beginning to close down, and now there are no good options left. They're all bad. At this point, though, as I see it, I fear that the United States has now itself become the problem in the area. We're no longer the solution. We're the problem. We're the lightning rod. We're the target of everybody. We're the focus of rage in Iraq and outside the region, and it contaminates those others, such as the UN or the Red Cross or others that in theory could come in and serve the needs of the Iraqi people. But if they're seen by radicals as part of this big American agenda, then they're attacked. So I fear at this point that the only way things are going to begin to quiet down is when the United States itself removes itself as a presence and a lightning rod and allows others to begin to work with it. Now, this is not a good scenario. It's going to be seen as a victory of the radicals. But if I believe that by staying on, you know, another 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, a year would improve that situation, then I would say, okay, we've got to stay the course. But the problem is every month it's getting worse and the anger is rising. So I don't see any longer any benefit in maintaining our extremely volatile or our extremely provocative, I should say, presence in Iraq and the region. I hate to say it, but we've got to allow other organizations, institutions, nations to help the Iraqis by themselves to work on their own and without our interference.
Just a final question then to Robert Baird. If we're damned if we do and damned if we don't, we're damned if we hang in there and things are likely to get worse through the summer, But if we pull out in everybody, including John Kerry, who's running for president against this administration, says that we can't leave a failed state. Now, I spoke a couple of weeks ago with General Odom, and I mentioned that. I said, how can you bug out and leave a failed state? And he said, well, we've already got a failed state. You know? So give me a sense, just in closing, what would happen if, for example, Karl Rove was able to whisper in Bush's ear and say, we've got to get out, we're going to lose this election, and somehow we declared victory and got out. What would happen then?
Well, let me just say first that Graham is absolutely right. We are not going to win anything. The sooner we get out, the better. But there, like everything else in the Middle East, there's a downside. And here the potential is that the chaos in Iraq, if chaos should occur, and I'm not going to choose one side or the other, the possibility of it moving, migrating south into the Gulf. What's the situation in Kuwait? It's very tense. Bahrain, the interior minister, was just fired over demonstrations, Shia demonstrations. That is really the downside of our getting up and leaving. But on the other hand, I can't foresee Americans keeping hundreds of thousands of troops, keeping the peace in the Gulf. It's just not tenable anymore. It's almost at this point we have to keep our fingers crossed that the Iraqis learn to get along and can somehow reach some partition of the country which doesn't affect the rest of the Gulf.
But what kind of this chimera of having the UN or somebody or NATO or Arab armies coming in there, that doesn't seem to be on the cards, and nobody wants to put their foot in that water, do they?
No, we've already destroyed the UN in Iraq by keeping the embargo on. We kept the embargo on to make Saddam disarm, or it turned out he was already disarmed. The UN is looked at as a surrogate of the United States. NATO, of course, is out. Other Arab armies, I couldn't foresee the Saudis going in. They'd be totally unacceptable to the Shia. The Iranians obviously couldn't go in and maintain peace in the area, nor could Syria. That's a really difficult position we're in. I think the damage has already been done in Iraq. We're just going to see how it plays out over the next couple of years. But I don't see any happy scenario, I say again.
And I guess you echo that too, Graham.
Absolutely, it's fairly grim. But I do feel we've got to cut our losses, not because they're our losses, but because I just don't see that our continued presence will. Yes, it might contribute to the stability for a little longer, but I don't think it's a permanent stability. It's just a keeping the lid on. At some point, when you take the lid off, there it goes.
I thank you both for joining us in Los Angeles.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the Central Intelligence Agency, and Robert Baer, a former CIA officer who ran the CIA's operations in the Kurdish North. He wrote a book about his experience of See No Evil, and a more recent book, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. I'm now speaking with Fidel Gate, who's a graduate of Cairo University and New York University. He's currently the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer and Company in New York, and he's spent more than 30 years in the oil and gas and energy sector and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan. And it is a pretty ironic situation, isn't it, Fidel Gate, where the oil markets repudiate the Bush family, or the son of the Bushes. I mean, I thought the Bushes were a pretty oil-friendly family. And here we have the international oil markets more or less saying, we think that there's so much instability in this part of the world, we're hedging our bets against a catastrophe.
Well, especially when we have a president from an oil state like Texas, one would expect to understand the dynamics and the politics of the energy markets and oil industry. But unfortunately, this administration seems to be making more mistakes. And as your two previous guests suggested, that there are no good answers, not happy endings, and things are getting worse than are not getting any better.
Now, why do you think that the Saudi terrorists who sort of many people think were al-Qaeda-lite, they weren't exactly the hardcore al-Qaeda guys, but they're a bunch of freelancers, but that indicates that the young Saudis or throughout the society are taking up arms. So, and also I mentioned how many Saudis have been involved. They're most of the hardcore guys in Guantanamo, Saudi, in Afghanistan. The Chechen leader that was recently killed was a Saudi, and apparently it was a Saudi who recently assassinated the head of the Iraqi Governing Council. So there's something going on there. But why is it then that the Saudis, terrorists or the Al-Qaeda surrogates, would go after Western oil workers and not blow up the oil fields, which apparently is not that difficult to do?
Right. It's interesting to see that people who hate Americans are in general those who are ruled by governments that are very much pro the U.S., whether it's Saudi Arabia or elsewhere. We've had very close relationship with the Saudi ruling family over the decades through Republicans, Democratic presidency. But all of a sudden, in the last few years, we realized that some elements within the Saudi population, in order for them to get back at their own government, the only way to do so is through a violent act against foreigners, especially U.S. citizens. And what we've seen yesterday in El Cover just underscores the trend. And I think 2 weeks ago there was a similar attack at Yanbu, and that is likely to continue. It's a trend, will continue, and unfortunately it's picking up more steam as more hatred and anger spread throughout the whole region.
But do you foresee at some time, and this is your job after all in the oil market, do you foresee a terrorist action in Saudi Arabia that could interrupt the supply? Apparently, it technically is not that difficult to really cause some serious damage.
Well, there are a couple of things. I mean, the facts on the ground are the largest oil terminal in the world is rest to Noura, and this terminal is pretty much the nerve center for the global energy oil shipment. It ships about 8 to 9 million barrels a day. It is capable of even shipping more, and has been for a while the potential target for a terrorist attack. I assume that it's very well guarded. I assume that not only the U.S., but Western interests are keeping an eye on the security of this terminal. But having said that, you just cannot, when somebody is ready to die for a cause, no matter what this cause is, you are going to find some that will be able to breach the security and cause a lot of damage. And what is driving the oil market today is not the physical supply disruption. It's the fears of potential supply disruption. The attack on Cobra yesterday will likely to push oil prices higher once trading starts next week, as it did the attack on Yanbu 3 weeks ago. The 3 days following the attack, oil prices moved up by almost $4 per barrel. Although there was no physical disruption of supply, but the oil markets are very jittery because they know that the situation is getting from bad to worse, and eventually we are likely to see supply disruption.
And these terrorists who took over the housing compound in Cobar, they apparently went to the guards who were guarding the place and said, "Okay, guys, you know, we have nothing against you. We only want to get the infidels." And the police essentially folded, and some of them were in fact wearing Saudi police uniforms. So that's why I wonder whether it wouldn't be difficult for these people to get into these oil facilities if they're guarded by the same kind of security that the housing compounds are.
Well, I assume or I hope that in addition to the Saudi guard or security forces guarding the oil terminals, there are Americans, European, and others who are not going to be fooled, or at least not going to give the green light to terrorist attacks. So I'm sure, or I hope, that there are layers and layers of security, including Saudi police and security forces, but I hope that there are also American and Western forces there.
But you don't know this for a fact. You just hope it.
I do not know that. But it goes without saying, since there hasn't been any attempt even, not attack, even attempt on the facility, one would assume that the people who are guarding the facilities are not Saudis.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Fidel Gate, who is a Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York, and we're talking about the oil market and how the price of oil has been run up, not because of any technical problem, any shortfall in supply, but because of the psychological conditions engendered by the instability in Iraq, and in, now we see more in Saudi Arabia. Give me a sense, Fidel, of how much dollars per barrel is the premium that we're paying because of insecurity. Because, I mean, it's not just Iraq, it's Saudi, it's also Venezuela. So just let's run through the main suppliers and how much a dollar per barrel premium we're paying because of instability.
It's basically, I call it the fear premium. And this fear premium is layered, if you will. We start with the strike in Venezuela, which pushed crude oil prices by $6 in 1 week. That came down a little bit, so I estimate that we have about $3 per barrel premium from Venezuela that's still embedded in the current price of crude oil, because Venezuela never restored its production to the pre-strike level. They were producing 3.1 million barrels before the strike, and after the strike, or since then, they could only produce about 2.4 to 2.5 million barrels, although Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, continued to say that we already restored production. The fact of the matter, oil companies who are running the projects in Venezuela tell me that that is not the case. And then we have the Nigerian civil war and unrest and all these things that took about 400,000 barrel a day of Nigerian oil export, which again pushed oil prices about $2 to $3 above where they were a year ago. The situation improved, but never came back to the pre-civil unrest level. And again, my estimation is Nigeria's situation has contributed at least a dollar per barrel. And then to go to the Iraqi situation, at one point, last year, a lot of people do not realize, a year ago, Iraq was not producing any oil. And now Iraq is producing over 2 million barrels per day. However, oil prices today are 40% higher than they were a year ago. Oil prices were $26 a barrel a year ago. They are about $38, $39, or $40 a barrel today. And they're going to open on Monday and Tuesday, I guarantee you, at much higher level because of the attack at Khobar yesterday. But the biggest fear premium, in my view, is in Saudi Arabia, because if the Iraqi oil production is disrupted, Iraq is producing only 2 million barrels per day. But if Saudi Arabia oil production is disrupted, that is almost fourfold what the Iraqi production is, and that is really what is going to push oil prices at much higher level.
Mm. So this is, I'm trying to add up the figures here. You got $3 premium on Venezuela, $3 on Nigeria, and how much on Saudi Arabia?
I would say Saudi Arabia will always carry a fair premium with about $5 per barrel. The Iraq situation right now is $4 per barrel, could go as, you know, depending on what the oil flow from that country will be. If disrupted, we could see oil prices going up to $3 per barrel. Therefore, the $4 premium that I assign to the Iraqi oil now could go to $7 or $8 in the future. Now, the Venezuelan premium is about $3. The Nigerian premium is about $1 per barrel.
Well, we're talking about close to $15.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, the fair premium. Now, one of the things that the Bush administration has resisted is tapping into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Right.
Clinton did it before. Now, I understand that basically what Bush is, and the administration is saying is absolutely bogus, that what happened before was by tapping into the Strategic Reserves, if the price of oil got above 35,
right,
it had an automatically leveling effect on the market.
Right.
And that the reason the market's gone up above the $35 mark to 40 is because Bush signaled that he wasn't going to tap into the reserves.
Not only that he did that, but we have to go back in history and see the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, better known as the SPR, was established under the Ford White House, Ford administration, and we started building this reserve in 1997. It was tapped twice in the Bush, the father in 1991 after the Gulf War, and that brought oil prices down by more than $10 per barrel in a few days. And then was tapped again at the very tail end under the Clinton White House by President Clinton. And at the time, he was accused of trying to help Al Gore win the presidency. But nevertheless, the impact was significant. Oil prices dropped by, again, $10 per barrel in a very short period of time. At the time, candidate George Bush was running against Al Gore, and when he was asked, he specifically said he would not do what Clinton did because that was not the intention of building the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It was not intended to manipulate crude oil prices, and he was absolutely right. It was only for national emergency, national security issues. When he was asked, what would you do? He said exactly that. He said, I will call upon our friends in OPEC and ask them to open the spigot a little to bring oil prices to a reasonable level of about $24 per barrel. Obviously, he has not done that. He has not called our friends at OPEC, or he called and they did not pay attention to his request because oil prices obviously have been over $30 for almost a year and reached an all-time high a couple of weeks ago.
And you're expecting it to get even higher on Monday, or on Tuesday?
Absolutely. What I'm afraid of, and I'm going to be wrong because I was hoping it was more wishful thinking that the Iraqi situation will cool off and things will go back on track, because I truly believe that the Middle East is yearning for stability. People want to send their kids to school. What people look at everything in America as positive. Unfortunately, our foreign policy is totally wrong and biased and unbalanced and incoherent, that is causing a lot of ill will and hard feeling. The fact of the matter is crude oil prices will continue to reflect the situation in the Middle East more than any part in the world, because this is basically the area where it could have tremendous impact on supply. So people are not looking only at Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the UAE. These are the countries that single-handedly could get oil prices to $100, and then we keep wondering, how did we get into the situation? Because we in this country, we created it, basically.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Fidel Gate.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So speaking then with Fidel Gate, who is the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas at Oppenheimer & Company in New York, and he spent 30 years in the oil business, having worked for Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan. I'm now speaking with Matthew Bunn, who is a senior research associate in the project on managing the atom in the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And he's also the author of a new report that just came out this week, last week, Securing the Bomb, an Agenda for Action. And clearly, I mean, is this a case, Matthew Bunn, that the United States government can only focus on one thing at a time, that so much of our focus is on Iraq, that we're sort of not focusing on what's happening in the former Soviet Union in terms of the fissile material, because we thought it was sort of under control with the Nunn-Lugar account, but your report indicates that it's not under control and that we're taking our eye off the ball.
I think it's clear that a lot of political attention in the U.S. establishment was shifted away to focus on Iraq. When you're organizing a major military invasion and then the aftermath of that invasion, it's inevitable that all of the top national security people will be focused on that project. And the reality is that as a result of that and as a result of other items on their agenda, they allowed summit after summit to go by, year after year to go by, with no presidential effort to break through the log jams that are slowing our efforts to secure nuclear warheads and nuclear materials in the former Soviet Union or in other countries around the world.
And what happened then to the Bush-Putin special relationship, where President Bush looked into his eyes and he saw the soul of a, I don't know exactly, I'm exactly trying to paraphrase his words, but he felt that he had a soulmate there.
Yes, they continue to have an excellent relationship, and it makes it all the more unfortunate that that relationship has not been used to overcome some of these obstacles. At their last summit in September of 2003, they laid out an agenda for U.S.-Russian cooperation, which literally did not mention the need to secure nuclear stockpiles. This is in a situation where Russian officials have acknowledged that terrorist groups are carrying out reconnaissance at their nuclear warhead storage facilities, where the 41 heavily armed terrorists who seized a theater in the middle of downtown Moscow in October 2002 considered, before they seized this theater, seizing the Kurchatov Institute, which is a site in Moscow with enough highly enriched uranium for dozens of nuclear weapons. This is a very, very dangerous situation, and our programs to secure those materials, while they are making progress, the progress is far slower than the potential pace of the threat. We need to get these things moving forward, and only presidential action is really likely to be able to do it.
Well, this week, the Attorney General took action. He went and had a press conference where he talked about an impending attack from al-Qaeda to disrupt the elections. The Homeland Security head did not accompany him at this press conference and distanced himself from those claims. And, of course, the Attorney General had, in the 9/11 hearings, had given a very partisan performance there, where he tried to blame the Democrat on the committee, Jamie Gorelick, for essentially disarming us because of this alleged war between intelligence gathering and in law enforcement that they were trying to sort of suggest as the reason why 9/11 happened. So he doesn't have a lot of credibility, it seems, you would think that somebody could say to the Attorney General, well, if you think that al-Qaeda is going to attack the United States, guess what? There's a ton of loose nuclear material in Russia, and if you're really worried about the next time around being a weapon of mass destruction, then there's where you should be looking. I mean, is that reasonable? I'm not sympathetic to him, but at the same time,
the warnings that came before 9/11 of that attack were sort of scattered, partial, and I think a plausible argument can be made that no one really had the information needed to see what needed to be done to prevent that attack. The same is just not true of a nuclear attack. We know what needs to be done. The warnings are clear. Osama bin Laden himself has said, I'm trying to get a nuclear bomb. He has demonstrated that he's doing that by repeatedly attempting to buy the nuclear material for a bomb, repeatedly attempting to recruit nuclear scientists to help them put the nuclear material together into a bomb. The documents seized in Afghanistan make clear that there is a significant effort to look into nuclear weapons on al-Qaeda's part. So we know that they're trying. We know from the physics that if they got hold of the nuclear material, it is quite plausible, unfortunately, that a well-organized and capable terrorist group might be able to put together at least a crude nuclear bomb. And we know that nuclear material is insecure in dozens of sites around the world. We know what needs to be done. If we can secure the stockpiles that exist, we can prevent nuclear terrorism from ever occurring, because the essential ingredients of nuclear bombs are too difficult for terrorist groups to make. But once they got those materials, they might very well be able to make a bomb. So securing those materials is the key to preventing nuclear terrorism, and we need to move out much more quickly than we are today.
So let's deal with why this stockpiles of particularly U-235, which is, I think, an easier route to the bomb, but there's also tons and tons of plutonium as well. Why would the Russians not want to secure this stuff? Or, because let's face it, they claim solidarity with us in the war, global war on terrorism because of their experience in Chechnya, which they're always trying to equate to our problem with al-Qaeda. In fact, they link al-Qaeda to Chechnya.
That's absolutely right. The Russians have taken a number of actions themselves to improve security for their stockpiles. Their budgets have been limited. But we have to remember that there is a lot of leftover Cold War suspicion at the working levels of both governments, especially in the security services, as the Russians like to say. For the entire Soviet period, the main thing that the security managers at Russia's nuclear sites were supposed to defend against was American spies getting into their plants. And the notion that having Americans crawling all over these plants and checking on every aspect of the security is part of the answer and not part of the problem has been a long, hard argument to make. So, unfortunately, partly because of these kinds of suspicions, bureaucratic obstacles have been allowed to grow up both in Moscow and in Washington. Disputes over exactly how much access U.S. experts should get to these sensitive sites as part of the cooperation. Disputes over if there's an accident, who bears the liability. Disputes over cumbersome visa procedures that we've put in place since the 9/11 attacks, which have made it almost impossible to get Russians cooperating in these programs into the country to work with them. Disputes over incredibly slow and arcane contracting procedures, both in Moscow and in Washington. One U.S. official put it to me that if there were an Olympics for bureaucracy, Moscow would take home most of the golds. Well, I would submit that Washington would take home a good number of the silvers.
Well, then let's turn to what resistance is there in Washington to this thing that you would think would be the highest priority in the government?
Well, I think there is a broad lack of understanding of how urgent the threat is. People think, well, we've been working on this for a decade. Surely it's all taken care of now. Unfortunately, that's not true. As of the end of fiscal year 2003, that is October of last year, which is the most recent official data available, only 22% of the potentially vulnerable nuclear material in Russia had been comprehensively secured. That's less than a quarter. Similarly, on the warheads. In fact, right now, today, about half of the sets of equipment that the United States provided Russia 4 years ago for what was planned to be a, quote, quick fix, unquote, of security at Russia's nuclear warhead sites is still sitting in warehouses because of disputes over who would pay for the installation and then if the United States would pay, how much access U.S. experts would get as part of the installation process. This is ridiculous. The two presidents need to step up to the plate and break through these log jams. At their next summit, Bush and Putin need to identify securing these stockpiles as a top national security priority for both countries. They need to reach an agreement on that sweeps aside the access issue and the other obstacles delaying progress. They need to set a challenging timetable. I've argued for securing every nuclear warhead, every kilogram of nuclear material within the next 4 years.
Well, again, you would think that this would be a mother's milk issue.
It is. There is strong bipartisan support in Congress and in at least some quarters of this administration and the previous administration. Both the successes and the failures have been bipartisan and have stretched from one administration to the other. I think one key issue we describe in our report a number of myths that lead policymakers around the world to believe that the threat is less than it is. And one that seems to be particularly prevalent in the Bush administration is the belief that terrorists could really only pull such a thing off with a state sponsor, and that therefore what the real answer to nuclear terrorism is taking on Iraq, taking on North Korea. But the reality is that there are hundreds of more plausible terrorist pathways to the bomb around the world, pathways that result from inadvertence, from a failure by states to invest enough in securing these stockpiles rather than from conscious decisions to hand this stuff over to terrorist groups. And that problem can only be dealt with by cooperation. It cannot be dealt with through force of arms. And what we need is a fast-paced global partnership to secure every nuclear stockpile, wherever it may be, because insecure nuclear material anywhere is a threat to everyone, everywhere.
Well, but I thought that there was, on our side, I mean, I understand that the psychological and cultural problems you have on the Russian side, that the KGB people have to do an about-face, and, you know, they were always afraid of the Americans finding their crown jewels, and now here the Americans are telling them how to get rid of their crown jewels. So, but on our side, I thought that one of the reasons that they were being chintzy and trying to cut back on this money from the Nunn-Lugar account to secure this fissile material was because people like Duncan Hunter, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, they don't like spending this money. They'd rather spend it on the latest jet fighter and whatever else.
I think there has been, for some years, a concern among some quarters on Capitol Hill, including Duncan Hunter, that these investments were bleeding off funds, Defense Department funds, that would be better spent on troops, tanks, planes, ships, etc. I think that's a wrong-headed view. I think if you look at the thousands of nuclear weapons that have been retired with these funds, the thousands of bombs worth of material that have been secured, the thousands of bombs worth of material that have been permanently destroyed so they can never be a threat to us again, that you would say this is an unbelievably cost-effective investment in U.S. national security. Right now, today, the amount of money we're spending on all cooperative threat reduction is 0.25% of the defense budget. That is not something that's, you know, bleeding away our military strength, and yet there is that concern, and it's part again of this broader distrust left over from the Cold War that's felt very much in some circles in Washington as it is in some circles in Moscow.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Matthew Bunn.
Good. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Matthew Bunn, who's a senior researcher at the Project on Managing the Atom at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government, and he's the author of Securing the Bomb, An Agenda for Action, a report that was just released last Monday.
I thank Louis Vandenberg for the research and producing this program. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell.
This program can be heard on ianmasters.org, on the net, ianmasters, one word, .org. Bye for now.